welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, brought to you by OU Israel. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Vayigash, first recording and broadcast of Yirtzeh Hashem, Thursday, December 28th. That would be the 7th of Tevet. The 7th of Tevet precedes three fast days, not just one. Most people, I assume, are aware of Asara B'Tevet and the 10th of Tevet, which this year comes out this coming Sunday. But then, on the books, we have a fast of the 8th of Tevet and another one of the 9th of Tevet. These two are referred to as Ta'aniyot Yachid, which means private individual fast days, in contrast to Asara B'Tevet, which is a Ta'anit Tzibur. Let me broaden the picture just so that all the listeners can follow. On the Jewish calendar, there are six required fasts. One of them is biblical. The only one, Yom Kippur, is referred to as Tzom, the fast. And there is no question about what we mean when we say the fast. It's Yom Kippur, the only fast mentioned in the Torah. It is a fast that begins shortly before sundown one evening and goes the full 25-hour, roughly, period until stars out of the following day, that day being the 10th of Tishrei. Not only is eating and drinking forbidden on that day, but so is bathing and washing, the use of lotions and cosmetics and perfumes, the wearing of leather shoes, and marital relations. That is a full, uncompromising fast day. Even the word uncompromising needs to have an asterisk on it, because in case of threat to one's life, eating, of course, and drinking is permitted. Okay. Add to that four fast days, which in one respect are lumped together. They are the four that are mentioned in the prophets. They are the four that relate to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, of the Holy Temple. They are the four that the prophet Zechariah prophesies will, in the time of the final redemption, be converted into Yamim Tovim, festive days. In the meantime, there are four fast days that relate to Churban Beit HaMikdash. Historically, we start with Asara B'Tevet, which is this Sunday, which is marks the beginning of the siege around Jerusalem by the Babylonians that led to the destruction of the first temple. I don't know if the word is psychologically, but it represents the beginning of the Churban, the destruction process. Then we come to Shiv'asar B'Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz, which marks the breach of the city of Jerusalem. The siege finally was over, so to speak. The enemy entered the city, and 3 weeks later, the temple was destroyed. There are different dates between the first and the second temple, but we associate the breach of Jerusalem to that day of Shiv'asar B'Tammuz. 3 weeks later is Tisha B'Av, the 9th of the month of Av, and that marks the destruction of both Batei Mikdash. It commemorates other things as well, so does Shiv'asar B'Tammuz. Let's not get into that now. The final of the four fast days related to the destruction is Tzom Gedalia, the 3rd of Tishrei, right after Rosh Hashanah, which in Rambam's language, Maimonides says it is the extinguishing of the glowing ember that remained alive following the destruction and the burning of the Beit HaMikdash. A poetic way of saying that it was the icing on the cake, in a negative sense, of the Churban process. Be that as it may, those are the four fast days from the prophets that are associated with the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. The sixth fast day on the books is Ta'anit Esther, the day before Purim. We'll discuss that at some other time. Let's go back to the four fast days. During the tenure of the second Beit HaMikdash, most people did not fast on any of those days. They were suspended because of the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. This is complicated, and I'm trying to keep it relatively simple. When the second Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, Tisha B'Av, the anniversary of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, went back into the calendar full force, which is why, till this very day, we're not allowed to eat or drink or do any of the other prohibitions and additional restrictions, and sundown to stars out the following day, and all of the strictness, almost all of the strictness of Yom Kippur. The other three fast days, originally after the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash, were made conditional. If a Jewish community found itself in relative peace and tranquility in their place of exile, then Tisha B'Av was the fast day that they kept as a reminder of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, but the other fast days were passé. They were not to be observed. If, however, a community was in a situation of oppression and persecution, which unfortunately many, many communities found themselves in, then those other three fast days were to be observed as full, complete fast days. Any community caught somewhere in between, it was up to their community, that community, to decide whether to keep and how to keep the other fast days. Asar B'Tevet, Shavuot B'Tammuz, and Tzom Gedalia. If you're following so far, let's take it one step further. Somewhere along the line, I can't tell you what year it was, but it was a period of time after the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, the second one that is, it was decided that the other fast days are coming back into the calendar without leaving it optional per community. And I imagine it was because of the difficult situations that many communities found themselves in. However, the rabbis at the time were faced with a little bit of a problem. The Sanhedrin that had decided that Tisha B'Av goes back full force did not include the other three fast days. Now they were going to include those fast days. They did not feel right putting all three in the same level of intensity as Tisha B'Av. It wouldn't be fair. It's a burden to the community. So they came up with the following compromise. Asar B'Tevet, Shivasar B'Tammuz, Tzom Gedalia, and Ta'anit Esther follows along for the ride, shall be what some people call minor fast days. They're not really. They are obligatory like the other fast days, the major ones, but they have built-in leniencies done on purpose, and part of what I'm saying now is practical for anyone who is fasting this coming Sunday. The leniencies that they built in were there because they felt uncomfortable requiring on the level of Tisha B'Av that which previous generation of authorities had not required. So they said, okay, on those fast days, except for Tisha B'Av, first of all, they'll begin at dawn instead of the night before, until stars out. That already is a bonus. That means you can eat the night before, and you can even wake up very early in the morning and eat before the fast, which you can't do on Yom Kippur and on Tisha B'Av. Second, only eating and drinking will be forbidden. The bathing, the use of leather shoes, cosmetics, marital relations, those are not restricted on those days. Tisha B'Av, yes. Yom Kippur, yes. Restrictions. Eating and drinking only is what's forbidden on Asar B'Tevet and the others. Third leniency, pregnant women, nursing women, men or women with a weak constitution who will be adversely affected by the fast. I don't mean just being tired or drained from the fast, but I mean something more than that. Any kind of threat to health, even not a life-threatening kind of situation, but if it makes a person sick or not well, doesn't have to fast on those days. A healthy person must fast on Asar B'Tevet. That basically is the Asar B'Tevet story, the type of restrictions. In addition, we also have to understand what has been added to Asar B'Tevet. We have, as I mentioned earlier, events of the 9th and the 8th and the 9th of Tevet, which became part of the identity of the 10th, the one that we do fast. And in more modern times, there is a Holocaust memorial aspect to Asar B'Tevet as well. It is referred to as Yom Kaddish Klali, General Kaddish Day, for observing as the anniversary of death those people who perished during the Holocaust whose date of death is not known. And that applies to a lot of people. Which in essence means that we're not only mourning once upon a time, a long time ago, the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, we're mourning the Holocaust as well, and a lot of things in between. I still have to tell you about the 8th and 9th of Tevet, especially because their meaning has been added to Asar B'Tevet, but we'll do that after Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir ha-ma'alot mima'amakim kraticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli tihiena aznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmor yah Adonai miya'amod, ki imacha ha-salicha l'ma'an tivarei. Ki viti Adonai kiveta nafshi v'lidvaro ho-cholti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim la-boker, shomerim la-boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbe imo fedut, v'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara uvashivya, ha-omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha-makom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha, u'meyafela l'ora u'mishibud l'geula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. Before I do get back to the 8th and 9th of Tevet, let me put the fast of Asar B'Tevet into a certain perspective, not a comfortable one. 1 week ago, we were still celebrating Hanukkah. Hanukkah ends with the 2nd of Tevet, as it did this year, and sometimes with the 3rd. 7-8 days later, we've got a fast day. Hanukkah celebrates a wonderful, magnificent point in Jewish history where we had victory and miracle and rejuvenation and recommitment to Torah and its values to service in the Beit HaMikdash. It should have been, it could have been, a situation of, and we lived happily ever after. However, the second Beit HaMikdash, the one that was rededicated by the Chashmonaim, the one that Chanukah represents, was destined to be destroyed 200 years down the line, and 200 years is not a little bit of time, but it is, if you look at the whole picture of ever after. What should have been was Hanukkah would be the light at the end of the tunnel. Instead, it turned out that it was a light in the middle of the tunnel someplace. When we got it and we passed it, things got dimmer and dimmer instead of brighter and brighter until eventually we begin to see a new light at the end of a long tunnel. If you follow that metaphor, you'll see what I mean by the context and perspective of Asar B'Tevet. Because Asar B'Tevet is the beginning, again, the beginning of the siege, the beginning of the destruction process which was brought about by lack of mitzvah observance, by immorality, by unethical behavior, and by a multitude of sins. That should not have been. And even though it occurred before the Hanukkah story occurred, it's a cyclic thing. It keeps happening. What I mean to say is that Jewish history continues its path. I called it cyclic, even if you want to call it linear. It's just got its bumps on it, and those bumps keep occurring. Had the Hashmonaim straightened everything out, who knows if the second Beit HaMikdash would be destroyed, but it was. Which means we celebrate Hanukkah, but 1 week later we mourn the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, and you cannot take that very beginning of Tevet and the 10th of Tevet, where the month is only a third of the way through, and already you're commemorating the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash again, without looking at Hanukkah and say there was something imperfect there. And the answer is, we are imperfect. We backslide. And this was a glorious backsliding to the point where the prophecy of Zechariah that Asara B'Tevet will become a festive day is still off in the future. To put it differently, wouldn't it have been nice to have an 8-day celebration of Hanukkah followed a week later by the festive celebration of the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash? But we're not up to there yet. And that's the context and perspective that I think Asara B'Tevet has to be viewed in. Now, to further complete the picture, or at least enlarge the picture, and examine it finally, we still have to add the events of the 8th and 9th, and then we have to add Parshat HaShavua too, which is a tall order, and I hope we'll get to it. But let's go back to the 8th. Our books tell us that the 8th of Tevet was the date of Targum Shivim, the first translation of the Torah into another language, specifically into Greek. It was not a voluntary piece of work. It was a forced upon us translation, which in essence resulted in the world claiming the Bible as its own, yet without benefit of the oral law and tradition. They have an incomplete version of the Bible, which they believe and claim is complete, or at least they say it might be incomplete for a different reason, but that has to do with the New Testament. We won't get into that now, but we're talking about what they call the Old Testament, what we call Tanakh or the Bible, which without our tradition to go with it, which they did not take from us, it opens itself to unbelievable opportunities of distortion and perversion. And we suffer at those hands. Many a time I have spoken about the difficulty in understanding Torah Shebichtav, the written word, without benefit of oral law, Torah Sheba'al Peh. And this is the anniversary of that event. We have sources who say that that day was as black to the Jewish people as the day of the golden calf. Exactly how to interpret that, I'm not going to get into now. I don't know if I understand the particular choice of comparison, but I believe with all my heart that it was a terrible thing that happened, and we have suffered for it greatly throughout Jewish history. The Torah is not complete without the oral law. You cannot understand a single verse almost without commentary. The commentary is the embodiment of the oral law and custom and tradition passed down through the generations. And there are times in the Torah where the literal, straightforward reading of a verse is not to be entertained at all. Classic example probably is an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Anyone, and there are plenty of people who have done this, who claims that Judaism ever suggested that an eye be plucked out as a penalty for someone who caused someone else's eye to be lost is distorting the Torah. It is not a modern invention that we go towards monetary compensation for injuries on a very complex system of five different factors. It is original. Eye for an eye was never, ever meant to be literal. Yet there are people who point to it, thanks to their access to the Bible via the many translations that exist, and say, ancient Judaism, traditional Judaism was barbaric, and we have come a long way since that time, and we say X, Y, or Z. That's part of the tragedy. Furthermore, oral law, oral tradition, requires that Torah be transmitted generation to generation, person to person. That does not happen when you've got everything in print. So, the oral law was not formalized in print until Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi did it with the Mishnah, but he purposely left it cryptic, but then the Gemara gave it its first commentary, and countless commentaries since, as a stand-up comic and convert to Judaism, Aaron Freeman says in his one of his comedy routines, why he explains his conversion to Judaism, he describes the book, five books, which have books about the books, and books about the books about the books, and commentaries on the books about the books about the books, about the books about the books, which is a good categorization of it. The world just said, give us the books, the five of them, and that's it, you're finished. And that's a problem. Part of the ongoing problem of Jewish history, which becomes a focus of Asara B'Tevet. In other words, on Asara B'Tevet, we're mourning a lot. We're mourning the fact that Hanukkah wasn't a happily ever after yet, that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, that the people behaved in such a way that the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, that people continue to behave in such a way that we're not privileged yet to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. Hold that thought. I have a famous statement coming up. You are listening to Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Vayigash, which is the day before Asara B'Tevet, both of which are relevant to what I am talking about. I'd like you to listen to a song which will sort of summarize the part of the 8th, 9th, 10th of Tevet, which we have not yet mentioned, and then after the song we will definitely mention it, but give a listen.
Yeah.
The National Religious Party in Israel, Mafdal, has a slogan. The slogan is adopted by them, was adopted by them. I don't know the history as to who created it, but I think people, apolitical or different political, but a sincere Jew, needs to take this slogan and personalize it, regardless of what party adopted it. The slogan is Eretz Yisrael La'am Yisrael Al Pi Torat Yisrael, the land of Israel to the people of Israel according to the Torah of Israel. I very much personalized it. I happen to be a person with a background in B'nai Akiva and an allegiance to Mafdal, although they've irked me in the last number of elections to the point of anger, but that's a whole other story. But the slogan is very much, and I don't want to even cheapen it by calling it a slogan, it is definitely an important definition of my sincere belief and goal. Eretz Yisrael, I believe, belongs to the Jewish people. Period. End of that part of the story. But the Eretz Yisrael to the people of Israel needs to be conducted al pi Torat Yisrael, according to the Torah. When Jews forsake the Torah, when Jews forsake each other, when Jews forsake the land of Israel, those are three separate acts of forsaking. Those are integrally tied with each other. In my opinion, that's the summary of who we are as a people. We are a people that have to be concerned for each other, that are not allowed to hate each other, even with cause, and certainly with no cause or weak cause. We have a Torah, and we have a land. And that was God's package deal. We have mitzvot bein adam la'makom and bein adam la'chaveiro, commitments to do things between man and God and interpersonal. The venue of mitzvot, the venue of Jewish life, is Eretz Yisrael, and that's where it's supposed to be. So this Eretz Yisrael, La'am Yisrael, Al Pi Torat Yisrael, is very, very important, and I think that all of that shows up on Tisha B'Av and on Asara B'Tevet. Since we're focusing on Asara B'Tevet, let's put it back in that perspective. Destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, which is not only commemorated by Tisha B'Av, but by Asara B'Tevet as well, and others, was the turning our backs on God, the forsaking of the Torah. That lost us our hold in Eretz Yisrael. But in a certain way, it was a forsaking of Eretz Yisrael as well, as a separate thing. Before that, the people of Israel. Sinat Chinam, which is the hallmark of the causes of the destruction of the Second Temple, is an ongoing theme and problem of Jewish history. This ties in with Parshat HaShavua, where you had the enmity between Yosef and his brothers. In Parshat Vayigash, it is coming to a climax and a reconciliation. But the Parshiot of Chanukah very strongly told that story of the problems between Yosef and his brothers. The Haftarah of this past Shabbat's Torah reading, I'm sorry, of this coming Shabbat, the Vayigash, is about the continuing problems between Ephraim, also known as Yosef, and Yehuda, also known as the brothers. So you had a confrontation in the beginning of Vayigash, you had a reconciliation, but obviously the reconciliation is not solid and it didn't hold, because the kingdom of Israel split, and the prophecy, as symbolized by the two branches upon which were engraved Ephraim and Yehuda, that miraculously fused together and became one, is symbolic of the future, the time of the Geula, the redemption, when there will be a reconciliation among the Jewish people and its various factions. So that's very much a part of Asara B'Tevet also. And the forsaking of the land, in the case of Tisha B'Av, is symbolized by Chet HaMaraglim, the sin of the spies, and in Asara B'Tevet, in a slightly different way, namely the events that are associated with the ninth of Tevet, the Yortzeit, the anniversary of the deaths of Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra and Nehemiah are the two people responsible for the return to Zion after the first exile, back to Eretz Yisrael with permission to build the Beit HaMikdash. Good, except that the overwhelming majority of the Jewish people had become complacent and comfortable in Babylonia and did not answer the call to return. The physical building of the second Beit HaMikdash, specifically as enhanced by Herod, made a magnificent physical structure, but spiritually, and tied in with that population wise was feeble next to the first Beit HaMikdash. The words that echo in my head, or I don't know if they're real from the time, was the response of many of the Jews of, we have everything we need for a comfortable Jewish life here in Babylonian exile. Of course, they didn't call it that. They said here in Bavel. Nobody says we have everything we need for a complete Jewish life here in Borough Park of Exile, in Muncie of Exile, in Teaneck of Exile, in Golders Green of Exile, but guess what? That's what it is. As far as the United States Postal Service is concerned, it's Teaneck, comma, New Jersey, zero, whatever, 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 whatever for the zip code. As far as Jewishness is concerned, it is Teaneck, comma, Galut, exile. And the same with Borough Park, and the same with Crown Heights, and the same with any other place where Jews live. Most of the Jews did not come back to Eretz Yisrael to build the second Beit HaMikdash after only 70 years of exile. Do we really blame Jews for not coming back to Eretz Yisrael after almost 2,000 years of exile? I guess in one respect, you can't blame them. On the other respect, when a group of new Olim from North America land in the middle of our snowstorm yesterday, well, snowstorm in Jerusalem, and they landed elsewhere, but when they got to Yerushalayim, it was snow that greeted them. But the faces of the groups and the individuals who met these new Olim, and you saw the joy, and you saw the wide range of ages and backgrounds that these people have, you realize that there are Jews who answer the call to return to Zion, be it with the help of Nefesh B'Nefesh, or the help of Ezra and Nehemiah. But that was the call. The same call that has been since Avraham was told, Lech Lecha, go. Jews have been called upon to come back to Eretz Yisrael. And they have, but not in the numbers that they should. So, if the ninth of Tevet has that kind of flavor, then it fits well, unfortunately, with Asara B'Tevet, where Asara B'Tevet is the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and the exile, and the ninth of Tevet is the lack of the wholehearted support for the return of the exiles, which meant a perpetuation of the exile in the comfort and spiritual religious atmosphere of the new community created in Bavel, or wherever. You get the point. Im eshkachech Yerushalayim, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, may my right arm wither, those psukim apply with whatever reasons a person has, conscious, subconscious, unconscious, or whatever, of not heeding the call to return to Eretz Yisrael. So if the eighth of Tevet represents a certain betrayal of Torah, and the ninth of Tevet represents a betrayal of Eretz Yisrael, and the tenth of Tevet puts those together and adds the dimension of a betrayal of the people of Israel by the people of Israel, then you have all three components of that original statement that I made, and this is what we are longing for, and this is what we should be working towards. We should be working towards Eretz Yisrael, which is Aliyah and support of Israel, La'am Yisrael, which means also not to restore it to full Jewish possession, but to restore the people to Eretz Yisrael, and to restore the people to each other. Then Al-Pi Torat Yisrael follows, and the whole package deal is the land, the who, the where, and the what. The who is the Jewish people, the where is Eretz Yisrael, and the what is Torah, Torat Yisrael. Now, to further focus in on this picture, let me add and elaborate a little bit on what I had just said before. This time of the year, that's Chanukah to Asara B'Tevet, let's call it, we're dealing with Parshat Vayeshev, Miketz, and Vayigash. Vayeshev, or let's put it like this, before Vayeshev, the problems that we had were with what have become our enemies from the outside. The Lavans of the world, the Esavs of the world. With Parshat Vayeshev, we have the hatred of brothers towards Yosef, the subsequent attempt to kill Yosef, the decision to sell him into Egyptian slavery instead, the punishment ordained that we would suffer Egyptian slavery because of what we put Yosef through. However you want to slice it, it is so clear, as one of the Midrashim says, that God said to the people of Israel, you sold your brother as a slave? I swear by your lives, says God, that every single year you will recite, Avadim hayinu lefaro b'mitzrayim. We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. It is makes you shiver to realize that that's where it came from. But Vayeshev, Miketz, Vayigash, that is the playout of Yosef and his brothers. It continues into Vayechi as well. And then by the end of Vayechi, they're all gone, and it's a new nation. But this is our background. As I said before, the Haftorah of last night, the Haftorah of this coming Shabbat, Vayigash, which just takes us centuries ahead, and we see that things haven't changed much. You want to put it like this? what are we as a nation fighting among ourselves for? Didn't you see what happened in the Torah with Yosef and his brothers? Yes, they had their differences. Yosef did things that angered the brothers, that they felt justified to strike out at Yosef. But it doesn't mean that they should have done that. It points to us by saying the rifts that exist in our community shouldn't be there. We have to work day and night. That's where our effort has to be. I don't know if you want to call it a reconciliation or whatever, because if you're a Torah Jew, you stand for Torah, and that has to be followed. There is no such thing as if you're religious, then you have to keep the Torah. If you're Jewish, you have to keep the Torah. If you're not religious, you don't. Not all the way anyway, but doesn't mean you don't have to. Biggest mistake people make sometimes is saying, oh, that doesn't apply to me because I'm not religious. What do you mean? You're Jewish? Yes. Then it applies to you. You don't do it, then you're not observant of that particular mitzvah. But don't say it doesn't apply to you. Whatever the friction between the brothers was, these portions of the Torah that we read now remind us of the negative in friction between the brothers. It does not have to be an Orthodox conservative reform, a Haredi, Chardal, Dati Lu'umi, religious, not religious, conservative this reform. It doesn't have to be any of that. It has to be, in order for it to be the same, clash and friction between Jews. That is per se bad. Even in the worst case scenario, where you're talking about Jews who defend the Torah against Jews who tear it down, who trample on it, it still cannot be Jew against Jew. It has to be the Jew against what those other Jews are doing. There's a big difference. It works on an individual basis also. You don't say to a child, you are a bad boy or girl. You say what you did is bad, and you're not supposed to do it. But that does not make the person a bad person, and even if it does, you don't call him a bad person, but you try to show him the error of his ways. And this goes for the Jewish world as well, not just the family. And before anyone reacts by pointing out certain individuals, obviously I'm generalizing, I am perhaps idealizing, but I believe what I'm saying, even though there are individuals that I would like to think, well, maybe I wouldn't like to think it, but I can't help but think that they themselves are bad because they do so much harm and so much bad, but I think it's most helpful and constructive to say, even, well, I won't even mention anybody's names, but to say this policy of the government, this behavior of the individual, this law or whatever is intrinsically bad, not necessarily you who made it or you who follow it, but it's a terrible thing and you have to be convinced that it's not a good thing to perpetuate. I don't know if that's too vague to get across my meaning, but we're winding down the show now, and the hopeful note is that Amir Tzashem, you know, Legula Shlema, that the Beit HaMikdash should be rebuilt, that we shouldn't need these fast days. Maybe I'll put it into this perspective. A book that I have on the fast days mentions the following in a footnote. One Hasidic Rebbe used to have a festive meal after the fast of Asara B'Tevet, which included wine and meat. And what he was celebrating is the Asara B'Tevet that can be and will be a Mir Tzashem in the future. On that note, I wish you a Shabbat Shalom, a meaningful fast, Ligu'ula Shleima, Lehishtamea. Okay, dear listeners to Torah Tidbits Audio on OU Radio, this is your time to hear the extra stuff, not what also goes out on Israel National Radio, Arut Sheva. This is the added stuff beyond the time constraints that I have from Israel National Radio. One thing I need to say, something that I never got to, but if you remember over 20 minutes ago, I referred to a famous saying, and I said, hold that thought. Now, this is the second time I'm recording this, because I lost a chunk of this extra recording. I hope I'll basically redo what I intended to do then. The statement is found several places in the Gemara. It has slight variations from place to place, but in essence it says, any generation in whose time the Beit HaMikdash is not rebuilt, it is as if it were destroyed in that time, or it was destroyed in that time. Any generation that does not merit by its own actions, I'm editorializing now, the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash, it's equivalent to being destroyed in that generation. What this does is change the nature of the fast days from commemoratives of a historical event in the past, which by itself would be okay, but it adds a dimension which makes it vitally contemporary. And that means that not only are we mourning the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, we are thinking over and over again, contemplating, reflecting, and hopefully doing something to bring about the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash. And if the agenda, as I have set it out, involves Am Yisrael, Eretz Yisrael, and Torat Yisrael, then the Eretz Yisrael part is Aliyah, the Eretz Yisrael part is support of Israel and Israel institutions, the Eretz Yisrael part is doing one share to straighten out government policies and see to it that we don't shoot ourselves in the foot or worse. Enough said on that. The agenda for Am Yisrael is to search and seek out ways of bringing about a reconciliation between diverse parts of the Jewish people. This does not mean forcing compromise when it comes to Torah observance. The Torah observant community is not willing to compromise, nor should they. But what they must do, what we must do, is find out a way to enhance the appreciation of Torah values and observance, show how it is the proper thing to do, even in our own times, when these people have been saying for a long time, old-fashioned, anachronistic, doesn't belong anymore, and don't tell me what to do. So we have to seek out the proper ways of educating the people and creating a greater groundswell of Baalei Tshuva, notwithstanding any government restrictions placed on bringing or attempting Kiruv for young people, but youth groups and programs and schools and special chugim in schools, many different ways to bring it about benachat, in a pleasant way that'll be palatable to the non-religious community. I always say, and I really mean it, we have a religious component of the community, and we have the not-yet-religious. There is no such thing as non-religious. Every Jew has a religion, and every Jew should practice his religion. And those of us who do and who are concerned with others should keep seeking and finding the right ways in which to introduce more and more people to the beauties of Yiddishkeit. It is a beautiful thing, and there's no reason why everybody shouldn't see that. It just takes work. And the Torah Yisrael is also obvious, part of what I just said, vis-a-vis the people, and part of it is increase of Torah learning, increase of Torah activity, mitzvah observance in an intelligent and pleasant way that people will be able to relate to and join. Anyway, that's the goal. Let's have another song, and then who knows what. Just before we do that, what I've just recently said is why a day like Asar B'Tevet is still on the books and is very important, and I didn't even get to discuss its Holocaust aspect of Yom Kaddish Klali, but as is usually the problem with Torah Tidbits audio, there just isn't enough time to do everything. I do want to mention that the tension between the brothers and Yosef calls to attention the serious need for working on our Bein Adam LaChavero. Remember that there is not, it's either a Bein Adam LaMakom, it's between man and God, or it's a Bein Adam LaChavero, an interpersonal. Every interpersonal is ipso facto, automatically, and also a Bein Adam LaMakom. So we're dealing with straightening ourselves out with God, and in His eyes, in a myriad of ways, including a strong emphasis on interpersonal interaction and behavior.
Yeah.
Let me conclude with a piece by George Carlin, a comedian whose humor I've always admired, whose vulgarity I could do without on some of his nightclub routines. But sometimes he expresses himself, and it's very profound and beautiful. This is a piece, I don't know how long it's been around, it's fairly recent, called The Paradox of Our Time by George Carlin. The paradox of our time in history is that we have taller buildings but shorter tempers, wider freeways but narrower viewpoints. We spend more but have less, we buy more but enjoy less. We have bigger houses and smaller families, more conveniences but less time. We have more degrees but less sense, more knowledge but less judgment, more experts yet more problems, more medicine but less wellness. We drink too much, smoke too much, spend too recklessly, laugh too little, drive too fast, get too angry, stay up too late, get up too tired, read too little, watch TV too much, and pray too seldom. We have multiplied our possessions but reduced our values. We talk too much, love too seldom, and hate too often. We've learned how to make a living, but not a life. We've added years to life, but not life to years. We've been all the way to the moon and back, but have trouble crossing the street to meet a new neighbor. We conquered outer space, but not inner space. We've done larger things, but not better things. We've cleaned up the air, but polluted the soul. We've conquered the atom, but not our prejudice. We write more, but learn less. We plan more, but accomplish less. We learn to rush, but not to wait. We build more computers to hold more information, to produce more copies than ever, but we communicate less and less. These are the times of fast foods and slow digestion, big men and small character, steep profits and shallow relationships. These are the days of two incomes but more divorce, fancier houses but broken homes. These are the days of quick trips, disposable diapers, throw-away morality, one-night stands, overweight bodies, and pills that do everything from cheer to quiet to kill. It is a time when there is much in the show window and nothing in the stockroom, a time when technology can bring this letter to you, and a time when you can choose either to share this insight or to just hit delete. Remember, spend some time with your loved ones because they are not going to be around forever. Remember, say a kind word to someone who looks up to you in awe, because that little person soon will grow up and leave your side. Remember to give a warm hug to the one next to you, because that is the only treasure you can give with your heart, and it doesn't cost a cent. Remember to say I love you to your partner and your loved ones, but most of all, mean it. A kiss and an embrace will mend hurt when it comes from deep inside you. Give time to love, give time to speak, give time to share the precious thoughts in your mind. George Carlin. I'm sure I didn't do justice to that piece. I was looking for a recording of George Carlin doing it himself. I don't know if it's there. Didn't find it. If you're looking for a written copy, do a search on the computer for The Paradox of Our Time by George Carlin and print yourself out a copy. It's a very well done piece. It is said that he did it shortly after his wife died, and reflections on the seriousness of life. So this doesn't come across with his usual flip humor, but I think it was worth it. On that note, Lehishtameah.